This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. In a pair of major decisions today, the last day of the term, the justices of the Supreme Court upheld Arizona's voting restriction and say that California cannot require nonprofits to disclose their donors. In the Arizona case, the six conservative justices found that two laws relating to collecting and counting provisional absentee ballots, did not violate the Federal Voting Rights Act. Many legal observers, including NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, say that in doing so, the court has basically made the landmark 1965 civil rights law a dead letter. The court also struck down a California law requiring nonprofits to file a list of their large donors within the state, arguing that by identifying large donors, it limits their free speech protections by exposing them to potential harassment. Here to talk about all of it and what the implications are for us here in New England is Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be on.
And also with us is Michael Curry, head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Michael, thanks for being here as well.
Glad to be here.
All right, Judge Gertner, I want to start with you, and let's start with the voting rights case. I think it's important to get some context here, so let's take a step back. We know that in 2013, the court had already weakened the Voting Rights Act with the Shelby County decision. Can you remind us what that was all about and what that did effectively?
So the voting rights statute was a way of dealing with what had been endemic in the South, in particular, efforts to undermine the voting of African American in our elections. And, you know, it started in, you know, in the post-Reconstruction era with literacy tests and poll taxes, which, though neutral on their face, were implemented both with the intent and the effect of eliminating or undermining African American votes. The Voting Rights Act, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, required that in certain states that had that kind of a history, there had to be preclearance, which means that before you change the voting requirements or the polling places, et cetera, it had to be cleared by the Department of Justice. In the Shelby County situation, the court essentially ended that in an extraordinary decision that said, I'm just paraphrasing now, discrimination is over. That was then, this is now, we don't need this preclearance anymore because the world has changed. Literally within days of the Shelby County decision, their efforts in across the South, principally Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, to restrict voting. I'm getting this from Justice Kagan's dissent in today's decision, which is, you know, that it took it really moments after the Shelby County decision, suddenly there were efforts to restrict voting. The net effect of which was to restrict voting for African Americans across the South. All that was left of the statute was Section 2, and that meant that you could claim after a law was passed, you could say, hey, that law discriminated against African Americans. You couldn't do it before it was implemented, which is what Section 5 required, but you could do it after the election. And that's what happened here. In Arizona, there was a challenge under Section 2 to the rules which had been implemented in the November election. Namely, if you voted in the wrong district, your vote can be thrown out. No one else could bring your votes to the polling place except yourself and election officials. The latter had the impact, particularly bad impact on Native Americans who lived, you know, miles and miles and miles from a mailbox even. And the former had an impact on the African American community who were frequently moving from place to place, transient. And therefore it was not there. The numbers of African Americans who were accidentally appearing at the wrong polling place were higher than for whites. So the notion was that these two requirements, the polling place issue, the vote harvesting, it was called, provisions were challenged under Section 2. And the six-justice majority said they are facially neutral and they're intended to protect against fraud, even though no fraud was shown.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But so from that, what does this mean for what's left of the Voting Rights Act? You can't challenge before. Does this mean you can't challenge after, or what does it mean realistically?
Well, it means that you can challenge afterwards. People can continue to challenge. They didn't invalidate Section 2. But the standards are mushy. The standards are mushy. Essentially, the arguable fraud, that's all that was involved in Arizona, is a sufficiently important state interest to justify burdening the right to vote. Arguable fraud, not proof of fraud, but arguable fraud. So the standards that were laid out by the majority are enough to decimate Section 2. I agree with Nina Totenberg on that.
All right, Michael, bring this home for us. Why does this matter to folks here in Massachusetts, and how is this decision resonating with you today?
Yeah, so I think most importantly, the judge laid it out perfectly. I think the best that I've heard in the last few hours in trying to process this decision, I would remind people when we talk about Reconstruction and we talk about, which I judge sarcastically referred to as the Obama years, where post-slavery, people thought we had made so much progress and that now there's opportunity. And out of that was born the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. But we know that there's always a backlash to progress, that there's a backlash to people accessing this right to vote and participating in the franchise. So as we sit here right now, end of July, 17 states had enacted 28 new laws that restricted access to the vote. So this is not about 19th century efforts to curtail the right to vote to vote for African Americans. This is about the 21st century effort. And unfortunately, that's born in large part by one party, by the Republican Party, and in particularly in the South. It's not new. It's why we needed Section 5 and why the decision in 2013 was a gut punch to many of us who have been fighting and for generations for voting rights. And this decision today by this court in a 6-3 decision is an additional gut punch. But, you know, I would remind you and all of your listeners when I say elections have consequences. This is what happens when you don't show up to vote. Decisions are made about judicial appointments, not only on the Supreme Court level, but on the federal judgeship level throughout the country. And they result in decisions that are adverse to the interests of people who care about democracy. And I think the dissent in this case really highlighted that, as Justice Kagan said, in a single statute, if a single statute represents the best of America, it is the Voting Rights Act. It carries two great ideals, democracy and racial equality. I think her words resonate in this moment.
Yeah, I'm struck by something in the majority opinion, which states the inconvenience of voting for some isn't the same as having unequal access to voting. What do you make of that argument, Michael?
I'm sorry, repeat that again.
The inconvenience of voting for some isn't the same as unequal access to voting.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's always the case, right? Whether it's counting jelly beans, you know, whatever the system that's been employed, you know, grandfather laws, you know, all the systems and tactics that have been put in place. I always use this, and I've said this on your program before. This is chess, not checkers. And chess is how do you control the demographics of the voting population in a way that benefits your party or your interests? That has always been the case, as the judge pointed out, since Reconstruction and even prior to Reconstruction.
Yeah, Judge
Gertner. That's the case today.
Yeah, Judge Gertner, just going off of what Michael just said, I believe that it was even said during oral arguments, those who are defending the Arizona law, that if it was allowed to be struck down, it would disadvantage them politically. What did you make of hearing that in arguments and how that plays into the decision here?
Well, that's extraordinary. But the decision doesn't, of course, mention that. I mean, the Section 2 could not be broader. Talks about, you know, the abridgment of the right. Doesn't talk about the elimination of it. Talks about resulting in the denial. It doesn't have to be intentional. They don't have to do it purposely, even though you probably could show that this was purposeful. You couldn't have a broader statute than this. And I think this is a shot across the bow by that group of six, that these cases are essentially, you know, they're not going to get involved in election stuff. They weren't going to get into gerrymandering, political gerrymandering. There was some basis for that in constitutional law because that's oftentimes difficult to figure out. But they're also not going to get into racially burdensome voting restrictions. I mean, the key here is there was no fraud that therefore necessitated this change.
But to that point, I want to read a little bit of Justice Alito's opinion. Quote, rules that are supported by strong state interests are less likely to violate Section 2. Fraud can affect the outcome of a close election, and fraudulent votes dilute the right of citizens to cast ballots that carry appropriate weight, end quote. Do you think states should be allowed to enact laws that deal with potential fraud, protecting integrity of elections?
Well, yes, but the potential fraud can't be a ruse. In other words, potential fraud here. There are other ways of monitoring, whether or not someone going to, you know, harvesting the votes, as I'm using their language, actually using Republican language, would amount to fraud. The concern about fraud could open the door to, you know, unless you have an embossed seal on your voting, on your vote, we won't count it. That is a requirement that has no end to it. And the most you can say is when that interest, you know, results in burdening African-American right to vote, it should give us pause. Let me just say something, even though I'm jumping ahead here. Think for a moment here. So this was a voting rights statute, arguably because of arguable fraud. It resulted in burdening, to whatever degree, African-American and Native votes. In the other case that the Supreme Court decided, which allowed, in which donors' identities were to be disclosed when they gave to nonprofits as part of the state's regulatory framework, there the court says, hey, there's a First Amendment interest here, and there isn't enough showing of fraud to justify producing the donors' names.
Interesting. Pause when you put them together like that.
That's right. You put them together. Fraud, you know, arguable fraud is enough to undermine the vote, but arguable fraud is not enough to require the disclosure of donor names.
All right. So we'll get to a little more on the donor decision in just a moment, but I want to stick with the voting rights one for just a couple more minutes. I can tell you're both pretty fired up about the decision. Are either of you surprised by it?
No, I'm not surprised. I think, you know, this is, again, elections have consequences. We knew, and I think there's some legitimate record that Chief Justice Roberts was targeted on this for a while now, that the addition of Justice Barrett is the direction we were heading in. And now that you have a 6-3 conservative court, it's not just about voting rights. It's about abortion rights, it's about guns, it's about affirmative action. It's all on the table now. So, again, no surprise, but it's the price we pay for not showing up at the polls and not making sure that we have a president who values democracy and can make sure that these things that are so critical are protected.
Judge Gertner, what about you? Is this a surprise or more kind of the next logical step after the Shelby County decision?
I wasn't surprised after the account of the oral argument before the court. What you've seen this term are the judges trying to, show that they are not, in one camp or the other. So there have been a number of 8-1 decisions and even 9-0 decisions, and numbers of commentators are saying, hey, that suggests that this is a court that is, you know, careful, deliberative, neutral, et cetera.
Right.
Actually, I think it's a court, at least some members of the majority, that are just holding their fire.
Totally
in some cases, reserving it for others, and this is obviously one.
So I want to talk... Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Mike.
Just the ACA decision recently was an example of that, right?
That's so, right.
We took a breath to know that they voted the way that they should have voted on the ACA, but I also said to friends in the legal community, let's not get too comfortable because other decisions are coming in. Here we see this decision today.
Yeah, the ACA, obviously the Affordable Care Act. I think that was a 7-2 decision. I want to talk about what this means because, Michael, you mentioned southern states specifically, but voting rights legislation has been kind of popping up, or I should say restrictions have been popping up kind of across the country. 48 states have something, more than 20 new laws restricting voting have been acted this year. My home state of New Hampshire has been talking about bills that would make it harder for college students who live in the state to vote. How could this SCOTUS decision affect states that are trying to proceed with those types of laws?
Well, I think it's momentum, right? And when any of us who've been in this work for a long time, and I have both on the national level as I chair the national NAACP's Advocacy and Policy Committee, and on the state level, I was involved in redistricting a decade ago. with the state legislature and even in Boston. It's momentum. And right now, the pendulum is swung, both based on the 6-3 court. There are victories that if you're conservative, you want to curtail the right to vote and curtail other rights, then you're feeling a victory in this moment. And quite frankly, you're going to see some other victories coming. I don't care if you're in New Hampshire or Des Moines, Iowa, or Seattle, Washington, or Montgomery, Alabama, and you care about democracy and justice, this should concern you, because this is about all of us and these issues. This is just the beginning. And there's some momentum that the conservatives who are trying to curtail those rights have at this moment.
All right, Judge Gertner, let's shift gears and talk about that donor decision that you mentioned earlier. Explain what this case was all about and how the court found today for us.
So California, like every other state, regulates not-for-profits. In exchange for that regulation, you then get tax advantages and other advantages, et cetera. And because there are so many not-for-profits in California, the state required that one of the things you file when you file your regular reports with the state was a list of your donors over a certain amount of money, those who gave over a certain amount of money, and you had to disclose it. And that was part of their regulatory aim. Presumably they would, you know, monitor who was giving to what to see whether, I'm not sure what the regulatory purposes were, to see whether they were, you know, following the rules. But in any event, they wanted donor lists for those purposes. They were largely confidential. There had been instances in which there had been information that had been released, but they were supposed to be confidential, and the state represented that they would be confidential. An organization backed by the Koch brothers challenged the disclosure of the donor lists, and the court says, and stay with me on this, because there is no need for the donor production of that list, because there's no showing of fraud. No need for it because there's no showing of fraud. And what hangs in the balance is the First Amendment. You really have to step back and say there's no showing of fraud, and therefore you don't need to stop donor lists, and the First Amendment is important. But when there's no showing of fraud, voter restrictions are just fine. I just keep on going back. Makes it easier to give money than it is to vote.
Well, and this is an offshoot of Citizens United, basically, right? They're calling money a version of free speech.
Well, that's right. Yes, it comes from that, and it actually puts on the chopping block potentially the requirements that, you know, one of the things that lasted after Citizens United was that you still had to disclose the names of donors in a political campaign. And the question is whether this decision would provide a rationale to even undo those restrictions. But you really have to, you know, apparently the right to give money to nonprofits ranks above the right to vote.
Michael, you've got experience with nonprofits. What did you make of this decision?
Yeah, I mean, you know, two of the key parts of how we ensure some accountability in our system is, you know, I think of it as the scale, and one side is accountability and the other side is transparency, and you want both to be balanced. And the scale is broken. In the case of voting rights, the accountability piece has been removed. In the case of this other decision, the transparency is removed. We need to know if there's undue influence in our process. We need to know if there's fraud in the process. We need to know who is investing where, for what purposes. And I think as a functional democracy, that just makes sense. And in fact, I would argue that many Republicans would look for that transparency in other places. And the contradiction is they don't want it in this case. So contradictions abound. I used the term once, politocrats, hypocrites and politicians. This is another decision similar to Citizens United that reverberates. And we as activists, civil rights activists and others will have to really mobilize, because we'll be working and fighting against it for years to come.
Judge Gertner, I was really struck by something in this decision that basically the reasoning seemed to be if you were exposed as a donor to some of these groups, you'd face potential harassment, and that they wanted to protect folks from that. Is that something the First Amendment protects us from? What's the legal leap there that's being made?
Well, there's a body of law that talks about associational privacy. And actually, it started with the NAACP case. It starts with, my lists my membership list should be confidential because I have a right to associate with whom I want, and there's a chance that if I associate, that my association would be undermined if you found out that I was a member of the NAACP or the ACLU or something like that. So there is, that's not an illegitimate concern, but when it's applied to donors apparently giving supposedly confidential information to the regulatory authorities of California, that's a different issue. That's not the giving it to the globe. That's giving it, it's giving it to a regulatory authority. Now, as I said, there had been instances in which information was leaked, but that the question then is whether you undo the regime rather than tighten up the leaks.
All right, a final question for both of you, because Judge Gertner, you said something at the beginning of the interview about this court basically being partisan but picking their spots, to paraphrase what you said. And I'm just thinking back, we've talked before on this show about the importance of faith in institutions like the Supreme Court. And that feels to me like a pretty cynical approach, if that's actually what's happening. What do you make of that, and how important is it for us to have faith in the Supreme Court as an institution?
Well, I think it's important for us to have faith in the Supreme Court as an institution. And certainly there have been there are indications that the six, quote, conservative judges actually have meaningfully different views on, for example, criminal justice issues. Gorsuch and Kavanaugh have split on mostly on criminal justice issues. And that reflects sort of real jurisprudential differences between them. But in addition, during this year, there have been a number of times that a major precedent has been upended. And you have a dissent from, it's usually Kagan, but it could be Sotomayor, that says, why are you overturning this precedent? What is coming down the block here? When can we wait for the next shoe to drop? And it's clear that these are dissents that are forecasting Roe v. Wade and are forecasting affirmative action. If you dilute, 30 years of precedent in Area A, there's a risk that it's diluted just as a principle in other areas. And so I'm looking at the dissents and looking at the discussion about something as bedrock, as precedent. And that's what I think this year represents, a number of skirmishes in a larger war.
Michael, briefly, last word goes to you.
Yeah, I'm a historian about this stuff as well as an attorney, but I defer to the judge and her deep knowledge. But I always think of the bookends for us is in the study, which is Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal. We didn't have faith in the system at that time. It was not faithful to equal rights and social justice. And then it came back decades later with Brown v. Board. Separate is inherently unequal. So there is ebbs and flows to this legal process, where at times we're proud and at other times we're embarrassed that decisions betray the ideals of this democracy. And again, we just got to keep fighting. We've always had to fight, and we have to keep fighting today.
That's Michael Curry, head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors, and Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst. Thanks so much to both of you guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At this hour, a major search is still underway off Castle Island for a missing swimmer. And as unfortunate as that is, it's been a sadly common occurrence this summer in Massachusetts. More adults and children have drowned in the state this year than in previous years. So we're going to ask why that's happening and how we can all keep each other safe in the water. And here to talk about it with us is Kelly O'Hara. She's the Associate Executive of the Merrimack Valley YMCA. She's also a lifeguard instructor and the former head of aquatics there. Kelly, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
So tell us, first of all, do we know why we're seeing more drownings this year? Are there multiple things contributing to this? What do we know?
Yeah. So first of all, I just want to express my condolences to all the drownings victims' families. Like, it is such a tragedy, and there are a lot of factors at play, especially this year. So there's a number of things happening, right? We've seen record heat, but in record heat, the water temperatures still are cold. So a lot of times what we don't realize is the water temperatures are still so cold in New England that your body can't handle it. And so you might go out into the water and then realize that you're just too cold and not able to continue swimming. We're also just coming out of a pandemic. And so access to swim lessons over the past year and a half have been extremely limited. And the way in which a lot of people learn, especially children, is that they need reinforcement to be able to advance their swim skills, to be able to continue swimming. And there's been no reinforcement because access to swim lessons hasn't really been there because of the pandemic.
There's also a lifeguard shortage right now, right?
Absolutely. It is very hard to find lifeguards these days. Across the state, nationwide, we are seeing that the numbers of lifeguards are far fewer than in past years.
You mentioned swimming lessons. Obviously, the pandemic affected that. What's the demand been like this year for you guys at Merrimack Valley YMCA?
So our demand is just starting to pick back up. People are starting to feel more comfortable coming out because of restrictions have been lifted. Cases of COVID have been decreased because it's been really hard to get people into a pool area and have someone else teach their child or themselves how to swim. That one-on-one contact, which is really important to learn how to swim and to have someone make you feel safe and reinforce those skills with you, is really difficult to pull off during a pandemic.
Yeah, it's really, this is something that hits me hard too. I have two young kids and they both love the water. And my oldest, we would have him in swim lessons, maybe not as frequently, but still in it year round. And that obviously stopped over the last year and a half. How I think a lot of folks approach it as, okay, it's summer coming up. Let's go take some swim lessons and get ready to go in the water. Is that the wrong approach? Is this something that we should really be thinking about year round? Would you say?
Absolutely. So we do see our numbers spike every spring, pandemic aside, but it's our busy season because people are like, oh, summer's coming. I need to get my kid back in swim lessons so we can go on vacation or do X, Y, and Z near beach, water, whatever. But really what we know is that children need reinforcement. So they need to be swimming all year round, even if it's not once a week. But continuous swimming really does help reinforce the skills and the knowledge in those young swimmers so that they remember how to do it, so that they're in good condition and good swim shape to be able to swim the following year, right? We do see a learning loss when we haven't seen a kid in our program since the following summer. So if they come back to us every summer, we know that that student will regress until they get back in the water and get back to regular practice.
Yeah, just like any kind of learning.
Correct.
So there's an equity issue at play here too. I saw a study from 2017 from the USA Swimming Foundation that found nearly 80% of children in families with household incomes less than $50,000 have no or low swimming ability, which makes sense if this is an added expense that some households just don't have the ability to swing. Some folks have suggested to deal with that, you know, swimming should be part of physical education in school. Is that something you support? And are there other ideas floating around out there to increase access to swimming lessons for everyone?
Absolutely. Any ways in which we can increase access will do us collectively good. The Y offers a scholarship, right? So what the Y does, it's a nonprofit. And so what we do is that if you can't afford to take swim lessons, we have funding available for you. That's why the Y raises money every year, is that we want to make sure that every child in the state of Massachusetts learns how to swim. So the Y is a really awesome resource for that. There's other organizations out there as well. The Boys and Girls Club, they do the same type of work where they have access to water, they have access to swim lessons. There's a ton of other organizations, nonprofits doing this work that is of utmost importance. We need to access the communities that struggle to have their youth learn how to swim, even their adults. Like, we don't want to limit this to children. Like, it is never too late to learn how to swim. I wholeheartedly agree that if we can get partnerships with school communities that really need this the most to get those swim lessons in there, that is really important to do.
All right, we are coming up on a holiday weekend, one that is commonly a beach or a pool weekend for a lot of folks. In addition to swim lessons, what are some things people should be aware of to try to stay safe in the water?
Well, number one is never swim alone, right? You never, ever, ever want to go out alone. And you want to make sure that you know your location, right? So if you're going to the beach, if you're going to a lake, a pond, swim in an area that is well known. Like, is there a lifeguard there? Are you swimming in front of the lifeguard in their zone, right? You want to make sure that you do as much as you possibly can to reduce the risk, right? We know that distractions are really dangerous. So parents, close supervision of your children. Put that cell phone away. Make sure that you know the structures, if there's a rip current, if there's a dam, if there's a waterfall. Stay away from those types of elements because there are unpredictable dangers associated with these elements. Make sure that if you're going out into open water, a Coast Guard approved life jacket is very, very important because you never know what could happen. Even if you are an experienced swimmer going out on a boat or a kayak, right? You need to make sure that you have that backup plan and make sure that you know who to contact, how to get help, you know, go in an area that is well protected.
Swimming in the right waters, it's interesting. Actually, today, Governor Baker is introducing legislation that would increase fines for entering or swimming in waters that the DCR, the Department of Recreation and Conservation, that aren't designated for swimming, that would raise fines to $500. Right now, it's between $20 and $200 because they're hoping to discourage people from swimming in some of those areas, kind of like you're talking about there. In terms of what drowning looks like, once we are at the beach or at the pool, what should folks be watching for, paying attention to? Are there warning signs that we can have in mind?
Well, so the warning signs aren't what you think. It's not the typical when you see, you know, in the movies or TV, right, where someone is making a lot of noise, yelling and screaming. That's not what it looks like, right? It's very quick, and most of the time it's silent, because what ends up happening is someone who is struggling in the water, it might be close to the surface and starting to sink. Making little to no forward progress is one thing that lifeguards look for when they're watching their swimmers to identify someone who might be struggling. Someone who might be hanging on another person. We teach some elements of safety in all of our Why Swim lessons. And one really easy thing to remember is reach, throw, don't go. That's one thing that we teach even our youngest swimmers to make sure that, you know, you don't want to jump in after someone who might be drowning because they have the ability to pull you under. And that's often not recognized, in that when you're swimming, if you're not prepared for someone to try to pull you down because they're panicking, that might result in another person getting into trouble and needing a rescue.
That's all really important information. That's Kelly O'Hara. She's the associate executive of the Merrimack Valley YMCA. She's also a lifeguard instructor and the former head of aquatics there. Kelly, thanks so much for the time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I have got a bone to pick, so to speak, with Bruce the Shark.
Right then, the meeting has officially come to order. Let us all say the pledge. I am a nice shark, not a mindless eating machine. If I am to change this image, I must first change myself. Fish are friends, not food.
That, of course, is from the film Finding Nemo, but as I said, I've got to disagree. Nothing says summer to me quite like a plate of fresh, delicious seafood. My most recent craving, admittedly, was for a plate of fried clams, bellies, of course, after a nice long day at the beach. So we're going to talk about that today, and I invite you to join the conversation as well. What's your favorite way to enjoy seafood? How do you cook it? How do you eat it? Or are you not a seafood fan? All are welcome. 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us for this conversation is Barton Seaver. He's Maine-based chef and author most recently of The Joy of Seafood. Barton, hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Nice to be calling
in.
And Jacob Afoa, owner of Mano Poke Shop in Somerville. Jacob, welcome to Radio Boston.
Aloha, brother.
All right. So, Barton, I've got to start with you. As I just said, your most recent book, The Joy of Seafood. I believe you've got almost 1,000 recipes in there. You can pick your top 500 and let us know.
Okay.
Talk about the joy of seafood. What does that mean to you?
You know, there's no ingredient category that's more compelling to me than seafood. Just all of its seasonality, tastes, textures, colors, aromas, the narratives behind it. I mean, what other food comes with sort of the expectation of tall tales surrounding its origins, you know, and how it came to us. It's just a fascinating thing to cook. And yeah, I mean, that's what it is to me. The joy of an ever changing, always delicious ingredient.
Jacob, what about you? What does that phrase mean for you?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Joy of seafood. What's that mean to you?
Oh, man. It means that my belly is full.
Now we're talking.
I'm a very happy person.
All right, let me ask you both, what's your favorite seafood dish, if you had to pick one?
Jacob, go ahead.
Oh, man. So where I'm from, we have a dish called fai'ai fe'e, which is octopus that we slow cook in coconut milk. We've actually served it a couple times as a weekend special at Manoa. And yeah, it's just the octopus comes out really tender, and it's just amazing.
Sounds fantastic.
Once we run it again, you definitely should come by and try it.
All right, Byron, what about you?
You know, it's more just like the base dish that's probably my favorite, because the seafood on top is so interchangeable. But I take a small cast iron pan and I get it rip roaring hot. I throw in way too much olive oil, a couple of whole cloves of garlic just lightly smashed. As soon as those begin to color, 2 pints of cherry tomatoes, let those sit, just roll them in the oil. And as soon as they get their skins blister a little bit, the juices begin to come out. I put a couple of pieces of fish right on top. Oftentimes it's, you know, salmon, but cod, hake, halibut, whatever you got is going to work. And then I throw the whole thing in my toaster oven under the broiler. Wait about 8-9 minutes.
All
what
right,
comes out?
Right.
You get this beautiful crispy skin and this emulsified, delicious tomato, olive oil, garlic, aromatic sauce. Serve it with bread. Family's happy.
We're going to put a pin in that, because you had me until you said throw it in the toaster oven. But I want to come back to that, because I want to go to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. Alan's in Wakefield. Alan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. And I think this is the most timely conversation I've had today about seafood. I feel like it's underrepresented, but just throwing some mussels on the grill, you know, get a foil pan or even I've made a foil envelope. And as the last caller said, overdo it with the olive oil. Then I throw in as much lemon as I can, some onions, some tomatoes, and then ideally a splash or two of Sam Summer. So it's just really, really great stuff. Underrepresented on the grill.
Alan, we'll all be over after the show. Sounds great. Get that grill fired up.
There we go.
Bart, let's stick with mussels there for a second. What's the secret to cooking mussels, would you say?
You know, just having them on hand. Mussels are one of my very favorite things from a sustainability perspective. They're a food that really we should be eating a whole lot more of. From a convenience standpoint, man, they're delicious, and they actually last in your fridge for several days, you know, when well cared for, just a moist paper towel on top. But literally the great thing about mussels, what do you have left over from your other meals? You have some roasted zucchini from last night. You got a half glass of white wine that you didn't finish. You've got some, you know, some herbs that you didn't quite use up. Great. Okay. Roasted zucchini and herb mussels with a little bit of white wine. There you go. Anything works. Red wine, white wine, beer, you name it.
All right. You mentioned sustainability there. I'd love to hear you both kind of talk about this. It's something we hear a lot about when we're talking about seafood. How do you think about sustainability when you're choosing a menu or deciding what exact fish to buy? How should that play into the equation?
Jacob?
I guess, you know, whatever's in season, we try not to overbuy. One of our favorites is local scallops. We like to make a passion fruit scallop ceviche, I guess you'd call it. We just try to see what's available at the moment and try not to overbuy, I guess, just us doing our part.
And there's a whole number of, I mean, this is what I've largely spent my career doing, is around sustainable seafood and advocating for just smart, healthy, reasonable choices. But a couple of very simple things we can do, you know, Chef mentioned it right there, Jacob did, with, you know, buy only what you need. The freezer aisle is a great place to start for sustainability. And nowadays it's also a great place to start for quality, but the least sustainable seafood there is the one that you throw away uneaten. So just buy what you need. Also, you know what? Domestic fisheries, there are sustainable fisheries all over the world, as represented by Marine Stewardship Council, Aquaculture Stewardship Council, Best Aquaculture Practices certifications. But domestically, we do a really, really great job with both farmed and wild fish. So if you see a Made in the USA label, if you see even better Made in New England or Boston, you know, Massachusetts label, by all means, know that you are driving your dollars directly into the heart of our America's, you know, I think, first heritage heirloom food, that of seafood, supporting your communities and doing good by the environment.
Amen, brother.
Jacob, I'd love for you to talk to us a little bit about poke, because not everybody knows even really what that is. I think some folks may have seen it but not experienced it. For folks who are newcomers, what would you tell them? What would you recommend they order? And talk about the different options you guys have at your shop.
Well, poke itself is the Hawaiian word for cut, or it's cube. So what it is it's cubed fish marinated in basically whatever you want to marinate in. But the classic poke would be the shoyu. Shoyu being, it's kind of like the slang word for soy sauce. So the classic shoyu would typically be fish marinated in soy sauce, a little bit of sesame oil, with onions, scallions. That's kind of our go-to here at the shop. That's actually our top-selling poke. We also provide like spicy tuna, spicy options where we throw a little bit of kimchi aioli in there.
Now we're scallions. Talking. Now we're talking.
Yeah. And but one of our favorite poke that we serve is only served on Sundays. In our culture, Sundays is more of like a family day where the whole family gets together and feast. And the dish that we make is called oka. We choose whatever fish we have available, and we marinate it in coconut milk, a little bit of citrus, Thai chilies, onions, scallions, and I'll throw a little bit of goji garu in there too.
Fantastic.
That's actually one of our favorites here, and I highly recommend that for first timers or trying the ahi shoyu or salmon shoyu.
All right. Alice is in Lynn. Let's bring Alice into the conversation here. Alice, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
I made fresh fish ceviche because I'm allergic to shellfish, and just onions, lime juice, lemon juice, fresh cilantro. It was put in the fridge, served really cold. Fantastic.
Wow. Either of you guys ever heard of that before? Fish ceviche?
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. Yep. You know, one of the things that I really like to do with ceviche, onions tend to play a recurring role in most ceviche recipes, is slice your onions really thin and then wash them under cold running water for just a few minutes. That just gets a little bit of that bitterness, a little bit of that funk and sort of potency out of them. And then just pat them dry. And what you end up with is this like sweet, earthy, wonderful, crunchy texture that marries perfectly and really sort of provides a platform and blooms the aroma of the fish itself.
Alice mentioned she's allergic to shellfish. Is there anything – my dad was actually allergic to shellfish too, so I wasn't around a ton growing up. I'm not as comfortable cooking. Any cooking tips specifically for shellfish? Is it different at all, or is it pretty much the same deal?
Oh, yeah. It's yeah, it's very different. And shellfish is a big category, obviously, you know, for everything from an oyster that you know to clams and mussels to lobsters and shrimp. But like everything else with seafood, it's I would say turn down your heat, low and slow. Give yourself some leeway. You know, shellfish, you have the benefit of cooking them in the shell, which not only helps to add flavor, but also retains moisture and texture. So have confidence. Just buy them. You know what? It's going to be delicious in any which way you cook it. So that's my advice.
All right, Jacob, final word to you here. What's your recommendation for one seafood dish you want someone to really celebrate the food of the sea here? What would you go to?
Oh, I'm out here. I really enjoy the Jonah crab claws. We just throw some, we make kimchi crab claws every once in a while when they're in season. And my God, that is one of my favorite dishes here ever. So yes, Jonah crab claws,
kimchi Jonah crab claws is my go-to.
There you go. Can't go wrong. All right, that's Jacob Afoa, owner of Mono Poke Shop in Somerville, and Barton Seaver, Maine-based chef and author, most recently of The Joy of Seafood. Thanks so much to both of you guys. I wish you a weekend full of delicious seafood to celebrate the 4th.
Yes, thank you, brother. Aloha.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Paris Alston, Walter Wuthman, and Amanda Beelan. We had help from Ali Audet, Stephen Gelman, and Hafsa Qureshi. Our engineer is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Satesh Hathi. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again tomorrow for a special holiday weekend hour of Radio Boston.